This is episode 99 of the Planet LP podcast, and I'm Ted Asfargadu. 4 decades is a long time. And when albums that were favorites once upon a time are now 40 years old, it sometimes feels like a gut punch. Really? That came out 40 years ago? People often comment on how fast time moves. Weeks, months, years are a blur, and the next thing you know, decades have passed. It's a strange sensation, but life is a one-way trip. But that doesn't mean we can't take time to look back at things that have meaning in our lives. And that's why in this episode, it's all about looking back at 2 albums that have a lot of meaning for yours truly and for Pop Dose's Keith Creighton. So let's get started, shall we? Years ago, there were a couple of albums that had a pretty big effect on us. For me, it was Learning to Crawl by the Pretenders. And for Keith, it was Talk Show by the Go-Go's. So Keith, you're from Ohio. So let's start with the Pretenders. Considering what the band went through before this record was made, it's a wonder that it exists at all. Learning to Crawl was that 3rd album. It was a tough one. The title is apt because we really did have to reassemble the band and carry on and learn how to start doing this thing all over again. Tough album to make, but obviously worth the effort because it did really well for the band. It was probably their, if it didn't exceed the sales of the 1st album, the self-titled Pretenders album, it was pretty close. I think they both sold about the same amount.
So Learning to Crawl, I think it was named after Chrissy Hynde. I think it was observing her niece, you know, who was a baby at the time, learning to crawl. Maybe her daughter, maybe. You know, so mark my words on that. But it is really about the band learning to crawl again and to rise up after the death of 2 members. And for me, it came in my high school years. And it was one of those things where I liked, but, you know, wasn't too crazy about the songs from Pretenders 1 and 2. We thought it was a little bit hokey, you know, the video for I'm special, and they're in the diner, you know, pointing to the special on the menu and all that. But then here becomes Back on the Chain Gang, where a song just hit me like a ton of bricks, where it wasn't just the melodies, but it was the arrangements and the chorus. There was something about it that struck so deeply in my soul. And I felt that similar kind of impact, like on the new Libertines single, Run, 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 where there's something about the chorus that just is so visceral that it's like, how did my life ever exist without this song and this chorus in my life? And then I really did like the B-side of that single because I still have my vinyl 45 of it. My CD was gone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's about Ohio. And I'm growing up in Ohio. And it wasn't until years later when I was living in Chicago and I was driving home to see my parents that the lyrics really made sense. Because at that point, the farmlands that we lived in got completely bulldozed and turned into malls.
You know, so she wasn't wrong.
You know, and it's one of those things where because my parents then moved from one neighborhood called Chagrin Falls down to Northfield Center, we're a stone's throw from Cuyahoga Falls.
Okay.
You know, so she mentions in that song from Seneca to Cuyahoga Falls.
Yeah.
And if you're in Seneca, you have really taken a wrong turn somewhere because it is in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the state between Findlay and Akron. And so the only times I was ever out there was when, you know, I was doing sales and had to go to small little drug stores and pharmacies out in the middle of nowhere. Quaint little small towns, people kind of stick to themselves, very Republican, right wing leaning. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things where in beautiful country, you know, but also now today filled with fracking. Lots of people have cancer, fire comes out of faucets, you know, and so a lot of my friends that stayed in that area of Ohio, some haven't lived, you know, have died young from cancer. Yeah. And so it's one of those things where that song just really hits me like a ton of bricks. But when you take it in context with the entire record, it's one of my probably top 25 records of all time. I mean, there is just not a dud track anywhere on the ton tracks.
No, it's a tight 40 minutes of really excellent songs that are varied. It varies in style. I was thinking about this in terms of what you were saying, that you didn't really connect much with the 1st 2 records, and that's understandable. Maybe it wasn't your jam, whatever. Maybe you didn't like Brass in Pocket. Honestly, when I first heard Brass in Pocket, when it came out, I didn't like the song at all. I wasn't even a Pretenders fan. I didn't become a Pretenders fan until the second album. Actually, the EP that came out called Extended Play that had Talk of the Town and Message of Love and a live version of Precious and the Cuban Slide. Great EP. And then the second one, I was in my junior year in high school when Pretenders 2 came out. For some reason, I really loved that record. I guess it just, you know, right place, right time, right age. I get it. Sort of uneven. What they were doing on the first album had that kind of punky vibe at times. She was being very blunt about sexuality and dropping an F-bomb here and there. It may have been a few too many years before you came into a kind of musical space where you were like, you hear Back on the Chain Gang, you're like, oh my God, that's the Pretenders? I love this song. But you heard Brass in Pocket, and you're thinking, eh, whatever.
It's no, I liked Brass in Pocket, but yeah. I didn't love it to the level of Back on the Chain Gang.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't even really until recently when that series Pistol, you know, about the rise of the Sex Pistols kind of told from the guitarist's point of view, where Chrissy Hynde plays a major character role in that, you know, the whole Vivian Westwood sex shop where she worked, where, you know, a lot of the Sex Pistols kind of hung out. And so I think it's cool that Chris Thomas produced this record, because Chris Thomas produced Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, as well as, you know, some of my favorite songs of all time, Common People by Pulp, you know, lots of In Excess tracks, my favorite Elton John song, I'm Still Standing. And he goes all the way back to Light and Dark with Beatles, the White Album, and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, where he has engineering credits on both of those records. And so,
the guy's been around for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So even though she's from my hometown, she really made a name for herself. And the band is very much a part of the London scene.
Very much.
And so it's a quintessential English record that just happens to have a tie to Northeast Ohio. And that's why it just has such a special place in my heart.
If you didn't know, if you had no idea that the lead singer and the songwriter, the Pretenders, where she was from, you had no idea she was American, you would have never pegged her as being from Ohio. One, her accent, maybe it's a function of being in England for so long, but her accent is so not from Ohio. You know what I mean? It doesn't have that Midwestern accent. At least I don't hear it. I mean, you're from Ohio, so maybe you hear it, but I don't when I hear her speak. You know, and the second thing is you've got three other members who, at the time, the first two albums at least, were British. For all intents and purposes, you think this is a British band because everything from the look to the style of the music to who they work with to where they're coming out of, where their home base is, all signals UK. And then you realize, oh, wait, she's American? When did she go to England?
Yeah.
Wow. What an interesting life she had pre-Pretenders. But then this album comes out, and we didn't really mention for people who don't know the history of the Pretenders, but two of their members died within, like, what is it, 7-8 months apart from each other in 82 and 83. I mean, that's a lot. And they both died from this roughly the same thing. It was a drug overdose.
And then over the years, Martin Chambers on drums has been in and out of the band. You know, so he was in as most recently as two albums ago. Last album, he was gone again, but this is one of his last ones that he was really on it. And it's also interesting to note that Tony Butler from Big Country contributes bass guitar on Back in the Chain Gang and My City Was Gone.
Right.
Because both, you know, Tony from Big Country wound up on this album and the drummer Mark Brzecki wound up on the Cult's Love album. So the Big Country guys were getting around as session musicians. And then Robbie McIntosh also begins a nice tenure with the band on this album. And he went on to play with Paul McCartney and have a really great session guitar. I think he does a lot of work with John Mayer, too. There's some really interesting members on this particular record, but it also sets into motion, okay, the Pretenders is Chrissy Hynde's brand. The musicians are going to change every album throughout the rest of their career. And then kind of segueing to the Go-Go's a little bit is, this was the end of the Pretenders trilogy when they were really a zeitgeist band, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Get Close had a nice single on it and all that, and she still got a couple of singles later in her career. This was the end of the trilogy. This was her Return of the Jedi, you know, that ended her at their peak of, oh, this is one of the biggest bands in the world. Same thing with the Go-Go's Talk Show. It was the end of their Imperial era with their third record.
So I'm thinking about all the permutations that existed post Pretenders 2, in which James Honeyman Scott, who was a guitarist, died from a mixture of cocaine with probably other drugs. his heart gave out, and then Pete Farndon, who was the bass player, and he died from a heroin overdose, but he was in a bath. He went into a stupor and then drowned in the bath. So once she puts together, she being Chrissy Hynde, put together what became the band for Learning to Crawl. As you referenced, it was Robbie McIntosh on lead and rhythm guitar and Malcolm Foster on bass guitar. Those four, and I saw them live on that tour, were a pretty good band. I mean, it was really tight. And I'm thinking, what would have happened if that was the band, if that was set? That's the new lineup. I'm wondering if they would have locked in on the album after Learning to Crawl, and it would have been just sort of like Pretenders Part 2 or Mark 2 or 2.0. And if it would have been something great, like when James Honeyman Scott was with the band and Pete Farndon was with the band. I know it's very speculative, but just given what we're hearing on Learning to Crawl, I feel like that this was a band that could have progressed on as that quartet in a pretty solid fashion. But then it became the Chrissy Hynde project where she swapped things out. Ironic in that she always felt like Pretenders were a band writ large. She says, I have no intention of becoming a solo artist. She said that for almost decades until she finally became a solo artist, even though, wink, wink, each Pretenders album after Learning to Crawl became almost like a solo project.
Has she ever released a solo record under Chrissy Hynde?
Stockholm was her debut. And then she did a second one, and that was in 2019. And that was called Valve Bone Woe. It was all covers of all different types of songs. But yeah, so she's done solo work. But like you said, that was the end of the trilogy. That was it. Learning to Crawl bookends Pretenders, Pretenders 2, and Learning to Crawl. That's the band. And then once Get Close and all the other albums come out post Learning to Crawl, there's not much that's there.
It stands out. I bought the last two Pretenders CDs, and they're good, but nothing really. I could have lived without them. You know, I think I was just more excited that she was still putting out stuff, especially two albums ago. I think it was Hate for Sale that had Martin Chambers back in.
Yep.
Because she keeps firing him because he's not, she says he's not a good enough drummer, you know, but yet he still keeps winding his way back in every couple of albums. And I do think it's fun that Paul Carrack from Squeeze is on this record, you know, because he would be a great addition too, you know, in terms of having like a really good harmony vocal throughout the thing. So I think, it is a lost opportunity that this band didn't gel and at least put out another trilogy of records. But Learning to Crawl, when you listen to it now, still holds up. I think it's an incredible record.
Would you say your favorite tracks, Back on the Chain Gang?
Probably say My City Was Gone, then Back on the Chain Gang, then 2000 Miles, which you have to hand it to them, became a perennial Christmas hit. You know, and then Thumbelina has some edge to it, you know, so I like that in Middle of the Road, you know, really kind of, especially like I really a huge fan of the Motels, especially when the Motels has some edgier guitar stuff. And so you put on Middle of the Road and Thumbelina with some really edgy Motel tracks in a playlist. And oh my God, it sizzles.
Yeah. I think Middle of the Road, obviously it's just a great album opener. I think for me, my favorite song is Time the Avenger. I just love that driving rhythm, the tension of the song. It's a bit of a sleeper song, but it's got a lot of power to it. And then there's that one song that just is tucked in right before 2000 Miles, which is I Hurt You. It sounds like Pretenders from 1980 through 1982. That to me sounds like the most of a Pretenders-like song, and same with Time the Avenger as well. I could tell that the writing was getting a bit softer for her on this record. Maybe she's got a kid, she's 33, baby, right? But she was 32 at the time. But I feel like Back on the Chain Gang, Show Me, 2000 Miles, or as you put it, the Christmas song, I like them just fine. When I hear them and when I heard them then, I felt a little like, the same band that rocked it hard with the other songs in the earlier part of the album. And I guess, I suppose so.
And I'm going to go because look at both Justin Timberlake, Beyonce, and Taylor Swift have now put out 30 plus track, 2 hour, multi-hour opuses. Both the Go-Go's Talk Show and the Pretenders Learning to Crawl, third albums, a tight 10 songs.
Yeah.
And that's all you need. And that's their immortal records.
Yeah. So
we'd love to chat quickly about the Go-Go's Talk Show, because I was watching the Showtime documentary a couple of years ago. I think it came out in 2020.
We're leaving Learning to Crawl now. They've learned to walk and they're gone. They're walking out the door.
There's some links too. We're going to keep bridging back.
Yeah, I figured we were like, we've crossed that meridian. We're ready to go on to the go-go's. And we can, that's fine. No, or we can go back and forth.
There's some links because just like your Ethan Hawke links on Taylor Swift, there are some yarn strings to kind of go back through. We already talked about this is their third album. Americans in London. That's the second theme because the Go-Go's were from Los Angeles, where Chris is from Akron. These are London records. I was waiting with bated breath for the Go-Go's documentary to get to Talk Show because Talk Show is one of my top 10 albums of all time. Any genre, top 10.
Dang. Okay.
And it's still, when I put it on, I'll listen to it probably once a month. Mm-hmm. And it still just gives me chills as much on subsequent listens than any other track. Probably of my top 10, this is also my most listened to album of all time because it's a really tight 10 songs and it takes you completely through the romantic human experience.
Okay. I was gonna say, you have it in your top 10. Tell us what's so special about this record, Keith. Why is Talk Show in your top 10 and you're about to go?
Yeah. So here's the thing. So I'm waiting with bated breath for them to get to the Talk Show era. And when they finally do in the documentary, the first words out of Jane Whelan's mouth is, "Well, I hear people like it, but oh my God, I can't stand listening to this record." What? Yeah. And it's one of those things where because where the band was when they recorded this album was they were all strung out on drugs.
Oh.
They were fighting over income because the ones that didn't write as many songs on the records were basically just session musicians and hired musicians.
Right.
Compared to the revenue that the songwriters were earning. You know, so mainly Jane Whelan and Charlotte Caffey were way exceeding, you know, income that the rest of like Gina Schock and Kathy Valentine were making, the bassist and drummer. The band strung out on drugs. Charlotte Caffey is so strung out, you know, she's grifting around London looking for fixes that Jane Whelan has to step up and do more of the songwriting. So when they finally kind of pulled down the songs that they're going to record, most of them were Jane Whelan compositions. And so she was like, great, I need to make some bank here. And that's when management says, nope, we are going to distribute the profits from this third album equally among all members. And Jane Whelan's like, fuck that shit. I'm out of here.
I don't blame her. Yeah. I do not blame her. I would be pissed too.
Because at this point, there was two things that really set this into motion. One was she had already had a hit with Sparks, you know, Cool Places. Cool
Places. Great song.
And so Sparks actually winds up, they collaborate on this new album also. The three of them wrote Yes or No, but she also went to bat for Forget That Day. It was a very anthemic breakup anthem, very dark. And so Jane wanted to sing lead on that track.
Since she wrote it, right?
Why not? Yeah. So the band says, no, Belinda's the singer. She's the star. We don't think you can pull it off. And so now they're denying her royalties. They're saying she can't sing the song. So she says, fuck this shit. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But they are contractually obligated to do a tour. So she has to do the tour. Then it turns out Gina Schock, who is in a lot of pain and everyone's like, okay, you're just partying too hard. Turns out she has a hole in her heart and needs to get surgery is at death's door. So here's a band that is at each other's throats, ready to break up and is basically already broken up. That's like, well, fuck it. We are going to go to Palm Springs and have one last bender of a weekend in case Gina Schock dies during surgery.
Oh my God.
And it is amazing. You know, once again, thinking about all the people, the musicians like Amy Winehouse, et cetera, that have died young, and this band and all the drugs they did at the height of their excess goes to Palm Springs, snorts cocaine, lives the high life, and lives to tell about it.
Yeah.
Long story short, Gina Schock got the surgery and is fine. They do the tour, and then Whelan's like, I said I was leaving, and I'm out of here. She leaves. The band is devastated because they're like, you can't just take 1/5 of a very fine working machine and remove it. So they wind up replacing her. And the woman that they replaced her with, her name was Paula. She, you know, this really tall woman, and the rest of the Go-Go's are very petite. They wind up doing Rock in Rio. It was an okay experience, but it didn't really shake the world. But then they started writing the fourth album, and Paula's contribution to that album was Mad About You, which became Belinda's big solo record.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of set in motion where Belinda is like, you know what? I don't need the band anymore. It's not the same without Jane. So Belinda and Charlotte wind up going solo, where Charlotte then goes into the shadows and becomes a songwriter for Belinda's solo career. Jane Wedlin has a great solo career, you know, really amazing albums. Blue Light, I think, was her big hit.
She had that song Rush Hour that was a single.
Yeah, Rush Hour is a big single. Yeah, yeah. So she has really good things. And so they all wind up going solo. But let's go back to somehow, with all this tension, with producer Martin Rushnett, they come up with the 10 best songs of their career.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It kicks off with Head Over Heels, which is the title of their Broadway show. You got to hand it to them. It's the falling in love. Everything's great. Like, our love story begins with Head Over Heels with one of the best piano solos in the history of recorded music. When Charlotte just goes completely nuts on the bridge with that piano solo, it's, to me, one of the best moments in all of pop music.
To a little bass riff too, that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, it really it just clicks, you know, like every single element. Martin Rushnett should be noted. He produced the Human League's Dare.
Oh,
he produced some of the greatest albums of the era, including by Altered Images. He cut his teeth doing like production work for Shirley Bassey, you know, of all the James Bond themes and all that kind of stuff. And so, but Martin Rushnett really put the shine on this record, where you can hear all the band members really shine with their instrumental parts. It's a well-produced record, because it goes right into Turn to You, which is the big fall in love song. And if you've never seen the video, it stars Rob Lowe, and all the band members both play girls in the 1950s and boys in the 1950s at a sock hop slash prom. So all kinds of debauchery goes on there. Mary Lambert, who did a lot of music videos and actually in feature films as well, directed that one. So, and then it goes into You Thought, where suddenly this romance isn't working out. Beneath the Blue Sky is just an amazing world peace song that we need now more than ever, because it's all about U.S.-Russian relations. Mm-hmm. And how we all need to coexist, or else we're not going to have humanity. And for a while after the Berlin Wall fell, and we were at that point of peace where, oh, our Russians are allies again, it seemed like this was a very dated song. And now Beneath the Blue Sky is probably the most relevant song in existence right now, considering what's happening in Russia, Ukraine, the Middle East, and here Red and Blue in America. Then we get to Forget That Day, a very gorgeous, dark, dark song by Jane Wedlin. And then you go into side two, you know, and it's just banger after banger after banger. I'm the only one, yes or no, Capture the Light. It ends with Mercenary, very beautiful, beautiful song. And you're going to come full steam with The Relationship Ends, the person finds their way forward on their path. It's just a very cathartic journey, you know, and the whole album probably is not even a half hour, you know, and it's just perfect, perfect, perfect songs. And I just love it so much.
Yeah, I looked up some of the album sales data, and their debut, Beauty and the Beat, went 2x platinum, selling like 2 million copies. The next album, Vacation, sold like 500,000. And Talk Show did about the same amount of business, about 500,000 units, as it were. Great songs, as you note. Songs that didn't do too much in terms of airplay or even video play on MTV. And then you realize, wait a minute, this band just probably recorded their best album. It turns out to be one of the strongest in terms of songwriting, production. All the elements seem to come together, but yet at the time, it just kind of languished. Why do you suppose that is? I mean, these are strong songs. It may have been in 1984. As you note, the Go-Go's were imploding in terms of their drug use, their personalities, their financial issues. But in 1984, did the Go-Go's music fit squarely into what was happening on the charts? I would say yes. So I'm surprised that some of these songs, like Head Over Heels, did pretty well. I mean, it was okay. But I'm the Only One, which I believe was I don't think it was released as a single, but I remember when I bought the record and I flipped it over, that's the lead track on side two, essentially. I'm like, this is really good. This is a fun song. And you can just hear hit all over it. But I'm wondering, like, why do you suppose this album languished like it did?
I think it was very clear, because remember, there was no internet back then. And so when you look at the Go-Go's media interviews on TV shows and stuff like that, it's very clear they did not like each other. They were strung out. I think Jane Wheeland talks about how they faked it on stage. I think they called it the Go-Go's bop or something, you know, where they all have their little dance in place thing that they do. But it was very clear it was not an enjoyable experience to go see the Go-Go's back then. They all looked completely baked and just wrecked. And so I think same thing. Look at what's happening in 94. Prince and the Revolution, Purple Rain. And when you actually look at, just Google any list of the top albums or the top alternative albums of 1984, so much was happening in terms of bands like The Cure and all that going Depeche Mode, going mainstream. There was so much exciting stuff happening in the pop culture zeitgeist. And yet here are these drugged out burnouts that just didn't seem as interesting. And so sadly, this record kind of got overlooked.
Yeah.
It's a shame because it really does hold up all these years later as one of their best. And I was shocked to prepare for the podcast. I was like, I was aware, and they talked about it in the documentary, that they turn Head Over Heels into one of those, you know, jukebox musicals. And I just assumed, what a great narrative for a story is five girls in Los Angeles and whatever could be happening, kind of like Rock of Ages was all the girl gets off the bus from Iowa and makes it in heavy metal music. That was a jukebox musical doing like the Def Leppard and the heavy metal songbook.
Right.
Or you look at like a really amazing story about a mother and daughter in Mamma Mia, the ABBA jukebox musical. So that's why I just guessed, you know, that Head Over Heels, the Go-Go's jukebox musical, would be about. And oh my God, if you are ever having trouble sleeping, go on Wikipedia, look at the Head Over Heels page for the musical, read the Act 1 and Act 2 synopsis, and you will be sound asleep in minutes. It is the thickest, densest Greek tragedy. You know, all the characters have Greek names, and it's all about the fall of a kingdom and a princess and some gender non-binary character, but this big Greek saga.
Wow.
And I'm like, and talk about stretch.
Yeah.
The opening track is, I guess, almost like the Force in Star Wars. The unifying front that keeps this kingdom together is the beat. And so the royals are singing about, we've got the beat as the beat keeps this. You know, it's the magical, mystical force that keeps our kingdom together. And I'm like, okay, you've already lost me there. And then the dynamics between the characters are so complex and confusing. I'm like, how the fuck did this become a Go-Go's musical?
And who bankrolled this? I mean,
yeah,
it's somebody like, had to have pitched it and said, and we need this much money. Yeah. All right, I'm all in. Here you go. You know,
here's it was kind of well received, you know, so I guess it might be one of those things you got to see it, you know, to understand it. But it only played for less than a year, both on Broadway and in Oregon at the Oregon Film Festival, which was kind of their pre-staging grounds. And it's only been licensed once for a third party production. So
I gotcha.
It kind of reminds me of back in the day when Stuart Copeland from The Police came to Cleveland to produce his opera. You know, that was going to go on a national global tour.
All right.
And the opera was so bad that it closed after the second night. And even my friends, you know, the weather lady at the Power 108 that was a big opera fan sat next to me in the theater, and she was sound asleep in the second act. Because it was the same thing. It was all about kings and knights and all this kind of crap. And it's like, I don't know what the hell's going on here. So
they're handing out toothpicks in the lobby so you could keep your eyelids open, right?
Just sort of exactly. Like, you know, considering that ABBA has made as much money, if not more, off of Mamma Mia than they did in their original catalog, shows a lot about what a jukebox musical could do. So it's kind of a shame that the Go-Go's got this particular one. Maybe they'll do another one someday. But they did do, you know, they didn't record again until 2001 when they did God Bless the Go-Go's. But they farmed out so many songwriters for that one, really centering around, you know, Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day, that that album nearly never clicked. And then it wasn't until 2020 that they did one more song, Club Zero, which is really cute. It came out at the same time as Book of Love's all-girl band. Both of those songs are about celebrating women in music. But I hope that if ABBA could come back 40 years later and do one more record, I really hope the Go-Go's do as well.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, it's possible, but given the fact that they're all thinking, well, I think I'm kind of done with that
stage
of my life at this point. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's, Talk Show's not really a bubblegum pop record. To me, it has a rock edge to it. There's more guitar present out front. The band overall was trying to chart this musical landscape, being less of a novelty band and one to be taken seriously in terms of songwriting and musicianship. That's how it plays to me when I heard it. But given all the backstory that was revealed in the documentary and what you've recounted for us here, it was a tough record to make. Just like the Pretenders had a tough record to make with Learning to Crawl, the Go-Go's Talk Show was not, let's try and reinvigorate our career in album number three and see if we can flourish. Instead, it ended in disintegration, whereas the Pretenders continued in various shapes and forms, but Chrissy Hynde always out front. So after 40 years, we revisit these records with a lot of fondness. And I think for you and me, we will go back and listen to each of these records. And I listened to both. I listened to Talk Show this morning before the podcast. I'm like, these are great songs. They take us back to a time when this music was new, but it's also, to me, that these songs endure in quality. I mean, it's 40 years later. It's hard to believe that these albums, they still have legs. They still have that staying power, at least to me.
And that ends this podcast on a high note because remember, the Pretenders were rooted in death, you know, when they got to this album. Considering how much conflict went into Talk Show, the recording of it, the fact that today in 2024, all five members of the Go-Go's are alive.
Yeah,
they're all pretty much grandmothers and they all hang out and enjoy each other's company, I think is the greatest happy ending ever.
I think so too. And I think that's a good way to close this out. Just as a reminder, both Keith and I contribute to Pop Dose periodically. Keith has a really great piece up on the site right now at popdose.com about the fan tax, essentially. This is something that is about being a completist and
buying. And I calculated how much it costs to buy those bonus tracks from Taylor Swift. And I have to go back and recalculate now based on the anthology coming out. So, but read the piece, you know, on the fan tax, because it talks about Taylor Swift and how much it costs to buy all of her songs.
And if you wanted to read more about the Pretenders, Learning to Crawl, I do a piece on that where I go back and relook at this record track by track. And that's at popdose.com. So there, just cross-promoted it. All great, all good. I think the podcast is wrapping up in terms of, well, this episode's wrapping up in terms of us talking about it. Keith, thanks again for being on the pod. Always good to have you along, my friend.
Always a pleasure. Can't wait for our next one where we really talk about all the other albums that came out this spring. Going to be future classics.
And thank you so much, dear listener, for listening. We'll talk to you soon.